DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet. From DW in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotte Lomas. Coming up on today's show, youth in Bali stand up against plastic waste.
And in 6 weeks, we managed to mobilize over 12,000 people in 55 different locations all around the coastline, and we collected 40 tons of trash that would have otherwise ended up in the ocean in just one day.
And regrowing efforts in Fiji offer hope for the plight of coral reefs.
But here at Mana, what I'm seeing is that all those coral that we are planting, most of them do survive, even though we've been experiencing an increase in the seawater temperatures.
All that and more coming up. But first we turn to Canada. In May this year, heavy rainfall and melting snow caused rivers in Canada's Quebec province to overflow. Some 3,000 people were evacuated and 4,000 homes were flooded. Experts say the floods are a wake-up call for Canada to do more to tackle climate change. Our reporter Sean Griffiths paid a visit to the region and filed this report from Gatineau, Quebec.
The Ottawa River today is gently lapping the Gatineau shoreline, but just a short time ago, it was devastating to the people here.
This was ground zero for the flood.
John Goodore-Savage, like his neighbours on Rue Jacques-Cartier, recalls vividly what it was like to be overwhelmed by the flooding.
It was like being in the movie Titanic, and the water was coming out of the seams of the basement, all the pipe holes, the sump pump. Parts of the basement I never even thought water could come out of.
But I did understand in one night the water rose 2 feet.
Yeah, it seemed to have risen about 2 feet. It came right from the road and it was just right up around the house, and then it just kept raining and raining. And
quickly, the road which lies along the river's edge became a waterway.
A friend of mine brought his canoes down, over 30 feet long, and we fit in tons of sandbags. So it was kind of like going back to the roots of this community. We were working 14-hour days with 3 hours sleep, and you're running on adrenaline. And
Marco LeBlanc, John's neighbor, stands outside the Italian-style white brick building he built himself.
We have too much work to do to try to save our house, you know.
Next door, a parking area at the rear of his daughter's house now looks like a lake. The tops of half a dozen cars and a boat are still visible. Marco's bedrooms and a living area were flooded with 4 feet of water, destroying the household contents, which now sit in a mound at the end of the driveway, destined for the dump.
It's a TV. I do have a pool table.
A pool table?
Yes, it's around there. I do have a bedroom set from my father. It's about 1940 set. A full set was gone. You see the desk over there, the mirror and all.
Sofas.
Sofas.
Clothing.
Clothing and see pretty at the table and a lot of stuff. Like you see the whole set. Oh, it's terrible.
And the same goes for many of the houses across this city. Mounds of wrecked furniture and sandbags stacked along people's driveways. It's as though Gatineau has just emerged from a siege. The army was called in to help here and in other parts of Quebec, including the city of Montreal. Battling this natural disaster overwhelms civic authorities.
Hey, Frank, peux-tu me sortir les stats de qu'est-ce qu'on a fait à date là?
At regimental headquarters in Gatineau, Lieutenant Colonel Eric Landry, a veteran who has served in Afghanistan and Bosnia, considers the nature of his adversary.
The enemy is the water and the weather.
And yet, this has been a big operation.
We filled and placed over 100,000 sandbags. We've picked up 145,000 sandbags. We rescued 174 people, and we patrolled over, 9,000 kilometers.
The army deployed 2,600 troops to meet the challenges posed by the flood.
Just like Venice. So the streets were filled with water. A lot of the houses had over beside the house, they had probably a meter of water. So, yeah, unheard of in 100 years.
As he toured flood-ravaged areas of Quebec, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau warned of more severe weather events due to climate change. One of the things that we are aware of is that the frequency of extreme weather events is increasing, and it's related to climate change, he said. We're going to have to understand that bracing for a 100-year storm is maybe going to happen every 10 years now, or every few years. His warnings echo that of the majority of the world's climate scientists, including Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa.
We've been setting records left, right, and center with climate change for a long time, but the rate is accelerating. And it's really ramped up in the last 5 years to decade. But in a warming world, we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Including carbon dioxide, emitted when we burn fossil fuels to power our cars, airplanes, power plants, and our homes. Beckwith says climate change has affected the behavior of jet streams, making weather events more severe for longer.
The jet streams have slowed down and are much wavier, and they guide storms. So their storms are moving across areas slower. So if it's a rainstorm, that rain is hitting one area more than it would before because the storm stays above for longer periods of time.
Friendly young assistants greet me as I arrive at the busy office of Steve McKinnon, Liberal MP for Gatineau. His office is on the sixth floor of a renovated heritage building, which McKinnon proudly points out is a net zero structure. His office is a few steps away from Parliament and just a short drive over the Ottawa River to his afflicted constituency. McKinnon, who visited the flood-devastated areas, says his government is leading the charge against climate change.
We have set out a very aggressive set of commitments to ensure that we meet our Paris commitments, targets that limit the temperature increase, we hope.
Canada has committed to reducing carbon emissions by 30% below 2005 levels by 2030, something McKinnon appears confident the government can achieve.
Many solutions to combating climate change are market-based solutions, do involve factoring in the cost of pollution, and that's why Canada has come up with a carbon tax or a cap-and-trade system. The adoption of renewable energy technologies, both in Canada and around the world, certainly in Europe, in China and elsewhere, is such that fossil fuels will someday ultimately be replaced. We have to wean people off of that oil. We understand that.
Yet critics point to a contradiction between the government's commitment to tackling climate change and its approval of new oil pipelines. Here's climate activist Katie Perfitt from the campaign group 350.org.
Then as soon as he got elected, within months, we saw that he approved three massive fossil fuel infrastructure projects.
We're standing by the Chaudière Falls, which tumble forcefully between the cities of Ottawa and Gatineau. They raged, lashing at the nearby bridge during the floods as the powerful Ottawa River burst its banks. Perfitt says the government's commitments don't go far enough.
Trudeau strutted into the Paris Climate Conference, championed in that conference hall a 1.5 degree target for global warming. Scientists have said, 2 degrees is the absolute maximum threshold for global warming, but that 1.5 degrees still would mean devastation in a lot of areas. I mean, we're not at 1.5 degrees yet, and thousands of people in the Ottawa-Gatineau region are experiencing climate impact.
I put the fan all around like this. That one's blew that way, the other one just come like this.
Back on Rue Jacques-Cartier, Marco Leblanc has fans and dehumidifiers on at full blast, hoping he can dry out his house to save it. This has been a full-time occupation. He hasn't had much time to consider the impacts of climate change, but he has a few thoughts.
Maybe they have to do some things, because you see that all around the world, they have some kind of trouble they don't have before, you know?
Do you think the government's doing enough about climate change?
I don't think so. They have to do something faster than that, because could be not me, but might be my son and my grandchildren, they're going to have lots more trouble than we have.
Shan Griffiths, DW, Gatineau, Quebec, Canada.
June 8 marks World Oceans Day, a global celebration of, you guessed it, the world's oceans. Oceans cover around 70% of the Earth's surface. They are the lifeblood of the planet. They sustain our livelihoods and are vital to regulating our climate. Coral reefs cover just 1% of the world's oceans, but support around 25% of marine life. Sadly, many corals around the world are under stress due to destructive coral bleaching from warmer sea temperatures. Scientists predict that by 2050, 90% of the world's corals will be dead. Still, a project on Fiji's Mamanuta Islands offers some hope. A group of individuals there are regrowing coral reefs with some success. Joel Carnegie was on Mana Island where he met Koli Matiyaga, a local man involved in the project.
So we've just made it down to the foreshore at Mana Island, overlooking the North Beach. And seeing what is in front of me is just extraordinary. You've got these beautiful pockets of islands just sitting out there in the blue ocean. It's so crystal clear. It's kind of like working in paradise. Koli, do you feel like you live in paradise?
Yes, just by looking at the scenery here. Nice, beautiful beach, nice blue ocean, and the nice backdrop islands that we have here. It's just like paradise.
Koli makes coral on Mana Island, one of the few sites in Fiji which is trialling the growing and installation of new coral in established coral reefs.
The reason being is that we want to give back to the reef ecosystem here on the impact that is associated with climate change, especially the increasing in the seawater temperature. And also we try to give back to those reefs that was damaged or affected from the past cyclone, which is the tropical cyclone Winston. We are trying to improve the health status of the reef here at Mana, and also to try and give back to the species or to all the fishes that are living surrounding the Mana Island. Yeah.
I had no idea that you could actually grow coral.
Yeah, growing coral is just like growing a small tree or plant. So we go out, we collect all those small coral fragments, and then we plot them, and then using each fragment we plant them onto each base. So normally we call the base cookies because it is shaped like a cookie and it has a small hole in the middle. So that hole will be holding the coral fragment, and then we'll be planting the fragment onto that hole, add a little bit more underwater epoxy glue, then we transfer the whole coral cookies and put them out there in the ocean, and we leave them and we do monitoring every week. If we see the coral survive, then we transfer that cookies onto the coral reef bed and they'll be their home for the rest of their life.
There are so many coral reefs around the world that are really struggling at the moment. The Great Barrier Reef in Australia is one of those, which is facing some very destructive coral bleaching. Do you see the coral planting program as a solution to the issues that are currently being faced by coral reefs?
Yes. At some point, yes, coral planting can be a solution to some of the things that are impacting our coral reef ecosystem around the world. But here at Mana, what I'm seeing is that all those coral that we are planting, most of them do survive, even though we've been experiencing an increase in the seawater temperatures, but still we do see the corals that we plant. None of them bleached out. So we are seeing that most of the fragments that we are planting, they somehow withstand the increasing in the seawater temperature, or somehow withstand the stress that is already present in the marine ecosystem.
So what you're saying is the new coral that you're planting into the reef is actually stronger or surviving better than the coral that exists currently in the reef?
Yes.
Koli spent his childhood here on Mana Island and knows this place like the back of his hand.
Let's head down there and see some of this work that you've been doing.
Socks off.
Socks off. Flippers on.
So here we are. We're in the water just off the beach. We've got some coral here. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Okay, most of the corals here, they are a mixture of all the coral genesis. So we have branching coral, brain coral, and table coral. But the most common one on this side of the island is the branching coral.
What's happening with the coral right now?
All this coral here, they are all healthy. None of them is showing any sign of coral bleaching or any sign of algal growth on them. So this is a good indication that the sea this side is in a healthy condition.
Oh, I've just noticed a school of fish just wander past. There they are.
So these are the fish which is one of the indicator fish. So they are the indicator of the healthy coral because they are associated with healthy coral because most of them mainly feed from all the coral reef ecosystem. So if we have nice or plenty butterfly fish, then that means there's a nice, healthy coral out there in the sea.
Essentially what you're doing is counteracting the effects and the behaviour of other people around the world. Here in Fiji, you're surrounded by a beautiful environment that is also under threat of climate change-related issues. Do you feel that's fair, that you have to almost defend your natural environment against the recklessness of the rest of the world?
No, it's not fair, yes. Because we have to use much and spend much in order to keep up with the level of changes that is already happening.
What would you say to someone, people, leaders of the world, who don't necessarily believe in climate change or don't have that level of appreciation or understanding of the effect of their actions? What would you say to someone based on your experience here in Fiji?
Climate change is real. It is happening. And if they can help out, please do help out. This thing is happening not only in other parts of the Pacific. It is happening right in front of us here at Mana Island. So we've been seeing a lot of changes like increasing in sea level rise, coastal erosion, which is one of the most biggest thing which is happening here at the island. And that's why I'm doing this, just to give back to the things which I know is already been impacted or been affected by such actions that we are doing. And also trying to let the future generation enjoy the things which I'm enjoying at the moment.
That story from Joel Carnegie in Fiji. Climate change is just one of the many problems facing the seas. Overfishing, deep sea mining, and pollution are also threatening the health of our oceans. An estimated 8 to 10 million tons of plastic ends up in the world's oceans every year, entangling marine life and entering the food chain. Since plastic doesn't fully break down, it simply collects and stays swirling around in the waters. According to a recent study, by 2050, there will be more plastic by weight than fish in the oceans. And that's a grim outlook. Luckily, there are some inspiring individuals trying to tackle this global problem. Meet 16-year-old Malati Vasan. In 2013, Malati launched a campaign in Bali to ban plastic bags. She and her sister founded an initiative called Bye Bye Plastic Bags to put a stop to ocean pollution. And it's had some success. Bali's governor plans to ban plastic bags by 2018.
My name is Malati. I'm 16 years old and I'm one of the founders of Bye Bye Plastic Bags. Bye Bye Plastic Bags is a social initiative or an NGO driven by youth to get the people on the island of Bali to say no to single-use plastic bags. We've done so many cool actions, but I think the most recent movement or sound that we've created is really with the One Island, One Voice, Bali's biggest beach cleanup. right, which took place in February earlier this year. Because we are on the one-year countdown of making Bali plastic bag free by 2018, our team came together and we thought, okay, well, what can we do right now to make sure that the conversation continues and that our voices as young changemakers are not forgotten? Because now more than ever, you know, our voices need to be heard. Now is not the time to be quiet. And so we thought, after having dinner with the team one night, we were like, let's make Bali's biggest beach cleanup. Let's do the whole coastline in one day. And so we brought together 21 of our partners and projects and initiatives, all working towards a greener Bali. And we sat together on a brainstorm, and in 6 weeks, we managed to mobilize over 12,000 people in 55 different locations all around the coastline, and we collected 40 tons of trash that would have otherwise ended up in the ocean in just one day. So that was definitely a wow moment for Bioplastic Bags team, where we really felt proud and motivated and re-energized, really, and reminded again of the people power, you know, the voices of the youth. We are ready for change. I think it really proved that the timing for change has never been better than right now. You can follow us on Facebook at Bioplastic Bags, Instagram also at Bioplastic Bags, and Twitter is BBPB_Bali.
Send me your location, let's focus on communicating, cause I just need the time and place to come through.
That was Malati Vaisan there talking to One Ocean FM at the United Nations Ocean Conference in New York. Shopping bags aside, so much of our plastic waste ends up in the oceans. And that's because our modern life revolves around plastic. Most of us barely even notice it. Open your fridge or pantry and take a look. How many plastic packages can you count? So how can we as consumers play a role in all of this? Well, our reporter Tamsin Walker took up the Zero Waste Challenge. For 2 months, she shopped plastic-free, trying to spend no more time or money than she would on a regular grocery run, with mixed results.
This is the sound of my experiment getting underway. Back in January, I decided to banish plastic wrappings from my life. I wanted to find out how feasible it would be, as a working, single mother of several, to buy everything I needed for cooking, cleaning and personal hygiene, either loose or packaged in paper, glass or aluminium. So, where to begin? My kitchen and bathroom cupboards. To be clear about exactly what I had in stock, I emptied everything from rice to shampoo to washing up liquid into glass jars. It was oddly nerve-wracking to see low stocks of everyday products on display, as I knew that replenishing them would require more than a trip to the supermarket. It implied inventive solutions. And, if I were to meet my self-imposed challenge of spending no more time or money on this new lifestyle, it also meant shopping locally. And therein lay the first problem. Most staples, such as rice, grains and cereals, come in plastic bags, and the only place to get them loose in Berlin is the unpackaged food store at the other side of the city.
How many staples, Mummy? Oh, just a few.
Since I don't have a car, it's a round trip of an hour and a half. Not ideal, but I reasoned that if I went there just once a month, I could stock up on the essentials and get the day-to-day stuff closer to home. And besides, the unpackaged food store is a more interactive shopping experience for the very young.
Can you hold it there?
No, you hold it.
You pull. Wait a second, not too many.
The idea is that you take your own containers, be they boxes, bags or bottles, weigh them, then fill them up with whatever you need from the dispensers along the walls. It's a beautifully simple concept. But beware small and enthusiastic hands, which can be a financial liability, as my almond and muesli bills went to show.
Oh, enough. We got a lot of nuts now.
I think that's enough.
Okay, what else do we need?
But as good as the shop is, it was clearly not going to be an everyday solution for me. What I needed was a network of places nearer home where I could reliably get fruit, cheese, vegetables, meat and fish. In the early days of the experiment, I thought I could import it, at least in part, into my supermarket.
Today did not feel like a victory for the zero waste efforts of this family. Actually, I felt very much like an outsider. What you're asking for is for them not to put a piece of plastic around a block of cheese. And they look at you as if you're A, insane, B, asking for something utterly unreasonable.
That left the market, which is close to home and open 4 days a week. And if I'm quick enough, I can do a bit of shopping between the school run and getting to work.
Right. I'm going to get some apples, putting them straight into my basket so I don't have to bother with any kind of plastic bag, which are hanging here. I'm going to get some carrots. Now I'm going to go and see if they'll put the whole lot directly into my bag for me.
And he did. Likewise, the fishmonger and the butcher are happy to put my purchases straight into a box I take with me. Though it's a little bit awkward when you forget, as I have done now on more than one occasion, to take the lid. I have had to get very inventive with a winter hat. So I now have our food needs covered and rarely have to go to a supermarket, which is a liberty in itself. But what about all the hygiene products? Starting with toilet paper, which is almost always wrapped in plastic. After a long internet trawl, I found a shop in Munich that sells it in a box. Having it delivered from 600 kilometres away is dubious, I admit. But in the interest of this experiment, I ordered some. And 2 days later...
Today I got a delivery, and I am assuming that it is my 24 rolls of toilet paper. And it is indeed not wrapped in any plastic whatsoever.
That still left things like shampoo, conditioner, moisturiser, floor cleaner, shower gel, and toothpaste. Having bought a job lot of bamboo toothbrushes, we needed something to put on them. So I went to a shop that sells tooth tabs in returnable bottles. They let you try before you buy.
I like it.
It's the first time I've tried it, but I like it.
Can we have one more try?
It was a short-lived passion, and the half-empty jar of tabs now sits sadly redundant on our bathroom shelf. Next up, we tried making our own from coconut oil, baking soda, and peppermint oil. How did that go down?
Not bad. I think it tastes like the salty water when we go swimming.
I think it tastes a little bit
around about here. Why did you put the disgusting things in it?
You can't say we didn't try. Ultimately, we compromised on metal tubes with plastic tops, which, like all our sins, get stuffed into an empty yogurt jar so we can see exactly how much waste we're creating. We've since worked our way through the remainder of the toiletries list, swapping shower gel for soap and liquid shampoo and conditioner for the solid variety. We make our own body and lip balm using cocoa butter and beeswax sourced in paper, which, I might add, was not easy to get hold of. Because the fact is, we do live on a plastic planet. It's so ubiquitous that I have, and this is somewhat embarrassing to admit, bought things wrapped in plastic without even realising until I got home. And given that space is tight in our yoghurt jar, I've started to upcycle. Most of the plastic that came to me inadvertently, along with any bags that predated this experiment, has been turned into reusable sandwich wrappers. The kids have them, as do probably more of my family members than really want them. But using this disposable material to create something that looks nice and has a longer life has opened my eyes to the idea of plastic as a resource rather than just something destined for the trash. And I like that. And it's not all I like. There's also the welcome relief from choice paralysis and knock-on effect of less clutter and a healthier diet. But is it a sustainable way of life? I'd say it is. In more ways than one.
Tamsin Walker there with that report from Berlin. Our program today was produced with the help of Eliana Giaducci and Jürgen Kuhn. You can listen to Living Planet anytime on iTunes or SoundCloud, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at DW Environment. I'm Charlotte Lomas. Until next week.